accession number 20457, rail 14.
Brigadier Randall, rail 14. I think you were saying that the number of scouts would really depend to some extent on the nature of the terrain.
Yeah, I think you want two, so one can cover the other. But I mean, if you were in sort of mixed country, well, the important thing is that each scout can see the other, and that the leader of the patrol, who he is, can see what the scouts are doing. If you're in close country, then they've all got to operate much closer. But then if you get out of thick country into open country, well, then you should automatically open out so that they can see each other, but that you don't run into the danger of being caught in the same ambush. So it required quite a lot of training, really, to get this right, and for people to adapt on a patrol in mixed country. And then all the problems of signalling and so on, which you can only really do by constant practice. So because signals you see on television, the chap just sort of does that, and everybody knows what to do. Well, it just doesn't happen like that in battle. You just do that for chap, and you can have a real cock up because he thinks that means one thing and it means something else. So unless you've got well-devised battle drills and soldiers who can know each other and know exactly what it means, you can have a real cock-up. So that all this getting the signals right, the formations right, required a lot of well-understood battle drills and people who could rely on each other and knew the drill.
Did you have a set of field signs of your own, or did you use the normal standard field signs?
I think we used the ones in infantry section leading, which I've forgotten now. But then people tended to, within reason, to adapt to their own, which is no bad thing, provided that it's quite certain everybody knows what a signal means.
Well, the important thing is to have a common understanding, isn't it?
Yes. You see, we had no radio down to... nowadays, of course, you've got radio down to section, if not down to private soldier, but radio didn't go below platoon commanders, so it was either signal or word of mouth. Well, very often word of mouth was not practical, so you had to rely on signals. So there was... To that extent, you had to be very much more practiced in signals than you do nowadays, where everybody's on the radio, you just tell them what to do.
Did you find that there were some people who were instinctively or naturally better at this sort of work than others?
Oh, yes. I mean, there are. Well, there's the chaps who tend to become NCOs, really. But the Indian soldiers were quite quick to learn this, but they could see the good sense in it. We became, as the war went on, we became very, very professional indeed. I was thinking only the other day, in the British Army, in all the operation places I went to, we were always having accidents for involuntary discharge of weapons. I don't think in Burma every chap had his weapon with his magazine. I don't think we ever had anybody killed by an accidental discharge. I'm not making invidious comment between the quality of the British or the Indian soldier, but the fact is that the Indian soldier took to soldiering naturally, and he understood what weapons were, and so in a sense you were dealing with chaps who took to soldiering rather more naturally than perhaps the British soldiers.
How long was this course that you ran for the platoon commander?
I think it was about 3 weeks, I think.
Mm. You mentioned doing patrolling and scouting. Do you remember anything else?
Well, we certainly did. I certainly did one or two set-piece attacks.
What level?
Well, these were toots, I mean.
Yes.
Well, at platoon level. In other words, they were... I, as the directing staff, as a commander, gave the company commander's orders. And then this chap had to give his order, his appreciation. But I tried to make it a bit more interesting than just two up sort of business. And also I remember one patrol, one exercise was of a platoon fighting patrol, because I remember the objective was Teen Darak Takri, which is the Urdu for Three Tree Hill, and that was the objective. I remember it still stuck in my mind. So I tried to make it of some practical value to what we might be involved in. Well, the CEO was quite pleased anyway. So that's what, and what is more, I think I taught chaps some.
Were these mainly Indians, the platoon commanders?
Oh, yes, darling. It was within the battalion, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And then I set about training my own company. Again, I had slightly revolutionary ideas because my attitude to going back into Burma was the soldiers were all at low health. So I concentrated on all I was getting them really fit.
How did you go about doing that?
Well, I had got them really fit, lots of modified, a lot of games, tremendous lot of food. And all I bothered about them was weapon training, because the Bataan loved things to do with weapons. So I didn't bother. And I concentrated on training the NCOs up, because I knew the soldiers, if they were fit and happy, that they would do what they were told. And the important thing was to train the NCO. I couldn't do everything. This is not in the textbook. I mean, you were supposed to... But anyway, this was my approach, was to concentrate on the training of my NCOs and just let the soldiers get fit. As long as I reckon that every soldier, if he was fit and happy and really could handle his weapons to a high degree of proficiency, that was all was necessary. It was not the sort of thing that would get you very far at the School of Infantry or the Staff College. But that was my theory, and the CEO thought I was an experienced enough officer, within reason, to give me a free hand.
What sort of games did they play?
I'm sorry?
What sort of games did they play? You said that they played. You made them play lots of games.
Well, we played some amount of rough and ready hockey.
Yes.
And a lot of volleyball.
Yes.
Volleyball, they love that, because any number of chaps can play virtually. And there's a lot of laughter and they play that endlessly. And hockey.
What about the food? I mean, did you have access to as much food as you wanted at Manchester?
Well, because we've been on half rations, I think the whole division was put on, I think, a higher ration scale for a bit, anyway.
Yes.
But you see, Bataans are one of those sort of wild I mean, there was this theory with Bataans. I remember some old colonel saying, the thing with Bataans is that they can be a troublesome lot. What you want to do is to work them from dawn to dusk on some interesting training, preferably involving weapons, send them to bed with a full stomach, be scrupulously fair and absolutely rock firm on everything you do, and laugh with them a lot, and you'll never have any trouble. Well, of course, you can say that for almost any soldier under the sun, actually. But particularly so with the Bataans. I mean, they could be bloody troublesome. But if they'd been out all day doing something interesting, have a really good meal, and if we had any dealings, you'd say, well, this is the way it's going to be, and I'm not shifting. And provided you made your mind up, you were right. Anyway, I had no trouble with them, and I think they responded to the. But it's not necessarily the formula that would go down in the modern army today, or necessarily with other soldiers, but it certainly worked with Bataans.
What sort of weapon training were you doing with them? Were they doing a lot of range work, or...?
Well, there weren't formal ranges there, but and there was a vast amount of India, so you could just go out. So you weren't firing on testification ranges at known ranges, but I mean, you could go out somewhere and you know perfectly well you could fire. So one probably better, you made up field firing. I mean, you had sort of jungle ranges with targets put out and the odd pull up and that sort of thing. And so the large numbers of soldiers could go down with opportunity targets sort of popping up, which is actually in many ways a rather better form of training for Burma than lying on your belly firing at 200 yards when you know it's 200 yards at a fixed target. And of course, there was unlimited ammunition, or virtually unlimited. I mean, it didn't seem to matter very much. And of course, every soldier then became proficient on the rifle, the Tommy gun, and the Bran. And they, of course, Batons love weapons. So anything to do with that, they're happy as sandboys all day long. They were built away.
And you said that you concentrated upon training your NCOs.
Yes.
What was your main focus there? What did you think they needed to be trained on?
Well, I mean, the whole thing of commanding a section, because there was always in Burma a lot of map, a lot of patrolling. I mean, navigation, map reading. Most of the, though they couldn't read, they could, most of them could read a map if they didn't know what was written down, but they could relate a map to the ground. So map reading was quite important. A lot on the drills of patrolling, how to the preparation and so on, and what to look for and all that sort of business. But again, I was dealing with chaps who'd been all the way through. So I wasn't dealing with chaps who didn't know what they were talking about. It was really picking out the points we'd learned and driving them home, rather than reminding them, I wasn't teaching ab initio. I wasn't like teaching Sandhurst cadet what it's like in war. I'm dealing with men who'd been there anyway. So it wasn't too difficult, really.
Did they bring up points of their own? And
well, one encouraged them to do so. Yes.
And they were able to do that. They could.
Oh yes, within reason. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's an important part of training when you're dealing with chaps who've had some experience. And also on the administrative side, because I've said earlier that the Indian soldier didn't need the amount of administrative supervision. It still couldn't be ignored. It was only that I, as the British officer, didn't have to worry about it, because I could rely on the VCOs and people to do it. It didn't mean to say one didn't care about it, but one left it to people who could do it best. But at section level, of course, the section commander had to do that. And it was really to give them confidence. That's the main thing, to give them confidence. Some of them had just been promoted up to command sections and things. It was really to give them the confidence in themselves.
Again, were you going out mainly and doing this on a practical basis?
Yes. Well, we went out day off to day, really, yes.
What were the rest of the battalion doing while you were doing this?
I think the other companies were doing the same, really. We were all trained. I mean, I was just one of four rifle companies, and then the support weapon companies were doing all the same.
Did you do any battalion training as such, or was it all down at
the company? No, we didn't, funnily enough. We didn't really do any battalion training. I don't really know why not, but we didn't. I don't remember going out on any battalion exercise at all during this period. Of course, we had extensive leave. Then there's these carders and things. So we pulled out in August. We got back to Ranchi about September.
Yes.
And we had Christmas in Ranchi, and then shortly after that we moved back up into Burma. So it wasn't an awful long period, really. But we, to answer your question, no, I don't recall a battalion exercise at all. In fact, I mean, I'm surprised we didn't, really, but we didn't.
Well, normally training is supposed to be progressive from bottom up, isn't it?
Well, it is, really. I think the CO took the view that he'd got four company commanders with a great deal of experience, and that the main need of the battalion was training up the considerable reinforcements we had in, and getting the devoting what time there was to training the soldiers and the NCOs, and that the company commanders were experienced enough not to need. I mean, to say we didn't need training would be a few, but time would, what time was better spent on low level training. I'm sure he was right.
You're saying that you had to absorb a lot of replacements who came in. Roughly, what proportion of your company were new men?
Well, I would think something like 30%, I would think. 30 or 40%. 30%, I would think.
And were these recruits? Were they?
Yeah. Well, we had the odd sort of NCO who'd come from somewhere else, but I mean, basically speaking, they were young recruits, yes.
How did they get on? How long did it take them to get?
They absorbed quite quickly, really. I mean, obviously, you didn't fill up one section entirely with recruits. So there were a couple of new chaps in each section, or something, whatever it was required, or three or four, so that the experience was not too diluted.
What was the level of skill and training when they arrived in the company? Had they done?
They hadn't been trained too badly, and by that time, recruits didn't come straight from the depot at Karachi as they had earlier in the war. They went via 15 Baluch, which was a battalion place called Chinwara, where they did jungle training anyway. So they had some experience anyway. I mean, they didn't come straight off a drill ground in Karachi. So on the whole, they absorbed very well, really. And of course, all they were dealing with section commanders who'd been in battle, and they absorbed themselves very well, really.
Roughly, how long would it take, do you think, for such a chap to be fully absorbed and become part of a useful member of the team, rather than still an apprentice and a learner down at section level?
Well, of course, he wouldn't really be experienced until he'd been in battle himself, and that's the acid test of any soldier.
Yes. They
weren't, after a bit, they weren't really noticeable. You couldn't say, oh God, look, there's a recruit. I mean, they seemed to pick it up pretty quickly, really.
Sort of, how long would it take before they'd get the hang of how to behave?
Well, in battle, it would probably take about a month, and then they'd you learn very quickly in battle. Yeah. Under training conditions, it would take perhaps 2 or 3 months, really, before they absorb. But it didn't until a Bren gun has actually fought his gun as number two in battle, and knows the drill about resupply of all that sort of thing. I mean, you can do so much training.
Yes.
But until you get there, I mean, so much of soldiering is on-the-job training anyway, as you well know, really.
Indeed. But, I mean, the better they do in the training before they go into battle.
Oh, yes, as long as they've got the basics right, yes.
The better chance they have of surviving. Yes.
But they absorb themselves very well, really.
Did you have a good period of notice that you were going to go back into Burma?
Yes, we did, I think. Yes, we did. We moved off just after Christmas, I think, or January it was, up to Imphal.
What was going on at that time?
The 14th Army then was pretty well was closing up on the Irrawaddy by then. Mm. We were then told we were going to have this very, very bold and really most imaginative operation of striking right into Mactilla.
Yes.
We became a motorized division, so we were issued with.
Did that happen while you were at Ramtree?
No, it happened up at Imphal.
Yeah.
We moved up and we got all our vehicles issued at Imphal.
Had you known that was going to happen before you got there?
I don't think we were told. We knew we were going back into Burma with the division. Yes. I don't think we knew the role until we got to Imphal.
I mean, while you've been doing this training, Ranji, had you been aware of what was going on in Burma, that the Japanese were beginning to...
Oh, yes. I mean, we got sort of news reports and things. Oh, yeah. I mean, we did take an intelligent interest in what was going on.
And you had access to good sources?
Yes, I think so, yes. What we didn't do, which wasn't possible, we did no infantry armour training. Yeah. That was a distinct disadvantage. Mm. We got our infantry gunner corporation, a result of Imphal.
Yes.
Brilliant, and the same gunners. So we were happy about that. I mean, that was good, but what we weren't aware of was that we were going to be operating with an armoured brigade, a close infantry tank and we had no training in that whatsoever.
Did you know anything about the theory of armoured warfare at all?
Nothing. We'd only seen a few tanks up at Imphal, and they were the odd tank that was brought up. I mean, we were going into an armoured... you know the Mactilla business. I mean, it was this armoured infantry thrust right into the heart of Burma. And we had to do a lot of work with the armour, and we had no training in it whatever. And we paid the price.
What were the implications of motorisation then to take stage by stage? When you got to Imphal... discovered you were going to be a motorised...
Well, I think most of us thought, well, thank God we're not going to have to bloody well march, really. we then suddenly had to find all these extra drivers. But fortunately, before in our recce retail, we having had a lot of Land Rover drivers. We had drivers, but there's a slight difference between driving a Jeep,
and a
three-tonner. But we got issued with all these... three-tonners, mostly American Studebakers, I think. But I think the theory is, well, this is marvellous. You know, we're going to ride into battle instead of marching.
What about things like debussing drills and things like that? Did you have to learn and practice those?
We did practice that, particularly sentries, air sentries and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And harbouring drill.
What was harbouring drill?
Well, for instance, supposing you had a halt or something. I remember, for instance, we had to halt once later on for let some guns through. So the radio said, B Company, such a village. So, I mean, you had to have a drill. So, I mean, the drill I involved was that I drove in the Land Rover to the centre of the village, having pushed a few scouts through first, and then I was the focal point, so the next platoon up went sort of left, next right, and then the third platoon came in behind. So you didn't... it was a standard drill, so everybody, whichever order the platoons were in, everybody knew where to go, and then you had a standard drill that you debussed, camouflaged up, cleared through the village, Bren gunners out, tea brewed up, somewhere to have a crap or pee or something, and so you didn't have to keep on giving orders, and we got very, very polished at it, actually, standard sort of harbouring drill. So wherever we harboured, I went in first, and from where I was, in the direction we were going,
they formed up round you.
I saw lager around me. I thought, well, the best thing is to put myself in the middle and so have my company protecting me, as I used to tell them.
How many vehicles did you have for a company?
I think we had something like about a dozen, I think. I think I roughly had 2 3-tonners per platoon. That's six. And then there was my own Land Rover, 7. And then stores and things.
Presumably you'd have... What would the scouts be? Would they be in jeeps? You said you'd send scouts into a village first before driving...
Well, I'd dismount them.
Oh, they'd be dismounted?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I think the leading platoon, they'd just dismount. I think, yeah, they'd go through them just to make sure there weren't a whole bunch of Japs there or something. Mm. and they double through it very quickly. I mean, 9-10, we never actually ran into anybody, but it was a sensible thing to do.
Security drill.
To make sure we weren't running into an ambush or something like that. And then I would then drive in, and then there was... No, they'd go on foot. Yeah. I mean, everybody was in 3 tonners, except me in a Land Rover.
How far outside the village would you stop to de-bust the scout?
Well, it depended, really. We'd halt. The lead platoon would be still in its vehicles, but with Bren guns and things absolutely trained.
Yes.
So that if there was the slightest trouble, they could bring covering fire down. And then the other platoons were way back out of it. So I suppose, really, looking back, we would have been wiser if we debossed outside the village and gone through. But began to take a few risks, actually. If the thing had been mined or something like that, it might have been a bit hairier, but it never did. But it was important to have the drill because breaks weren't all that often, and the quicker you could get yourself sorted out and have a cup of tea and everybody could have a pee and that sort of thing,
the better
it was, actually. Mm.
When did you first hear that you were going to be operating in cooperation with Armour?
When we were at Imphal.
When you were at Imphal?
Yes.
Did you meet the tanks there? Or
no, they weren't there.
They weren't there.
Don't know where they were. They weren't there. You see, we did this very long MT march right down the Cabourg Valley and then down the...
Yes.
It took us about 10 days.
Mm.
And it was done with... Though it was dry, there was a lot of dust. The whole idea was to keep it from... The chaps had no idea that a whole corps, 2 divisions, were moving down there. Mm. The Japs believed that the British were obsessed with Mandalay and that all our efforts would be in the general area of crossing the Irrawaddy near Mandalay. And so the whole idea was one of deception. And I know that there was a tremendous amount of British air cover over us, so the Japanese had, there's not the slightest chance that they would have any air recce over us. They did, actually, the last time I was ever strafed was just about short of the Irrawaddy. We went suddenly, we're so used to our own aircraft, when suddenly somebody said, Christ, or the Urdu equivalent, it's a jet fighter.
It certainly wouldn't be Christ, would it?
No, it wouldn't be Christ, no. But, you know, it's actually good Lord, you know. we were strafed for a bit. But anyway, there was such a heavy British air cover over the top of us that the Japanese weren't able. In fact, they never did. They never had any idea, from all counts, that the British were in such strength. Then, of course, the 7th Indian did cross the Irrawaddy at Pococu, near Pococu, and we were held back undercover until they cleared it. And then we joined up with this Indian Armed Brigade. It only had 2 regiments, the Provins Horse and the Deccan Horse. And that was the first time that... we met up with the Armour.
What sort of tanks did they have?
Shermans. But you see, we had... Communication was a great problem. There was no... Our radios weren't compatible with the tank commander's radio, so he couldn't flick across to us. So the only way you could communicate with the tank commander was by shouting at him if he could hear you over the tank engine. Or to go up and talk through the tank telephone at the rear, which was all right for him. But if you were under any sort of fire, I remember saying to a chap who was sort of banging on, I said, look, for Christ's sake, you know, I'm sitting outside your bloody tank being shot at. And we never really cracked that one. Mm. I mean, we got used to operating with squadron commanders there. No doubt about it, we would have done much better if we'd had an opportunity to do some training. The other thing was an infantry sort of where the tanks go and how you give supporting fire, mutual signals and so on. And it was it creaked a bit, really.
Did you have any sort of advice or orders on how you were to coordinate and interfere with the armour?
You were just told that you were going to do an operation with C companies or C squadrons, and certainly during the Battle of Mexico, I was sent off in Indo.